interspersed with this inspirational talk of faith, was a challenge. Why can't the United States do something to stop the gunships? We can't hold off the world's largest power with our bare hands. The DSHK bullets only bounce off the armor. What could they do with no modern weapons and so little ammunition? The slaughter was intolerable. Wilson invited Mojadedi to join him and Joanne for lunch at the Democratic Club. Almost immediately, Joanne began to sing the praises of an Afghan leader she had gotten to know when making her documentary with Charles Fawcett. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar was his name, and she had found him marvelous beyond words. The meek-looking professor became instantly agitated and began, in a most remarkable fashion, to denounce Gulbuddin as a true monster and an enemy of Afghanistan. He accused Gulbuddin of being a dangerous fundamentalist, busy assassinating moderate Afghans, a man no self-respecting nation should support. If nothing else, Joanne Herring has the courage of her convictions. Zia himself and the Pakistani leaders had told her that Gulbuddin was the Afghan they respected most. She held her ground. It was an explosive argument, with neither side yielding, but with Mojadedi saying some very disturbing things about Gulbuddin's alleged bloodthirstiness and his Islamic radicalism. America would be sorry one day if it didn't stop favoring him, he warned. In the aftermath of 9/11, the CIA would find itself agreeing with Mojadedi. In March 2002, it launched a satellite-guided missile in an attempt to assassinate Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the Afghan leader who had been the largest recipient of CIA weapons during the jihad. But back then, Wilson figured that he had just stumbled into some ancient tribal rivalry, and that it made no sense to try to figure out who was right and who was wrong. The only relevant question in the face of the great Soviet evil was whether they both were trying to kill Russians. Of that he had no doubt, so he temporarily put out of his mind an issue that would later cast a shadow over the CIA's great victory in Afghanistan. Wilson decided that Mojadedi could be a powerful advocate for the Afghan cause and set about trying to arrange an audience with CIA Director Bill Casey. Wilson knew all about Casey's dream of finding a country where the United States could begin to roll back the communists. Casey believed it would happen in Nicaragua, but Wilson thought that if the old OSS spymaster could just meet the Afghans, he would buy into the plan to fund a radical escalation of the war. Only after some bullying did Casey agree to receive Wilson, Mojadedi, and his brother in the corner office he maintained in the old executive office building next to the White House. The great patron of anti-communist freedom fighters listened as Professor Mojadedi described the experience of having a Hind helicopter sweep in on an Afghan village. Mojadedi was still recounting the horror stories to Casey 15 minutes later when he and his brother asked if they could excuse themselves to pray. Wilson describes Mojadedi as a born performer and says he suspected that the Mojadedi brothers orchestrated the call to prayer for effect. But at the time, even Wilson was moved as they took their prayer rugs to the far corner of the suite, turned to Mecca, and began to pray loudly. While this unusual scene was unfolding in the CIA director's office, Wilson saw a moment to drive home his point and whispered, "Bill, we're just allowing these brave men to sell their lives too cheaply." "Charlie, there is no silver bullet," Casey replied sincerely. "Well, there's got to be some way to knock those hinds down, or at least make them think they're going to be knocked down," Wilson answered. The Mojadedi brothers rejoined the conversation just as Wilson started to talk to Casey about his wish to put the Orlikans into the war. "I'd like to have a heavier cannon, too, but it's just too expensive," Casey said. "Mr. Director, you don't understand that money is not the issue here. We'll fund anything you want. You ask for it, and I'll pay for it." Wilson remembers Casey looking at him as if he had come from a different planet. Congress was trying to close down the Contra War completely, and he did not seem to believe that Wilson was for real when he declared, with the Mojadedis listening in amazement, "Mr. Director, I'm going to drown you in money." What Charlie Wilson did next has no precedent. Throughout the Cold War, the CIA and the White House had always acted alone in deciding how much money would be spent on covert programs. Congress's only role was to rubber stamp the requests or try to stop them. Never before had a congressman presumed the right to throw money at the agency to escalate a secret war. More unthinkable, however, was Wilson's chutzpah in dictating what kind of weapon the CIA should introduce into a covert operation. Radical as his plan might have been, Wilson had no real doubts about his ability to win the votes of his 11 colleagues on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. Each year they gathered behind closed doors, like justices of the Supreme Court, deciding how to spend hundreds of billions of dollars for the nation's defense. They wrestled, of course, with the awesome responsibility of spending enough to protect the country while maintaining fiscal responsibility, but there was also the very human question of pork. Each of the 11 men had to stay in office, and there was no better way to do this than to bring home the bacon, the jobs, the schools, the highways, the bridges. And as everyone in Congress knew, there was no more effective pork than a piece of the giant defense pie. Wilson occupied a special place on this committee because he asked for little and almost always supported everyone else's pork barrel proposals. Murtha had his research grants for Penn State, and Norm Dix was always trying to relocate much of the defense establishment to his district in Washington. Charlie was always gracious in his support, and since he had absolutely no defense contractors in his district, it was never a question of a quid pro quo. And now, in the case of the Oerlikon bill, Wilson was not asking his colleagues for billions. All he wanted was $40 million for a cause, shooting down Soviet gunships, that not even a liberal Democrat could find fault with. He was like Fred Astaire sweeping across the ballroom when he floated from the subcommittee with approval for the full $40 million, $17 million of it earmarked for an anti-aircraft cannon to bring down the Hind. This first step had been almost anticlimactic in its ease, but next he had to persuade the defense appropriations from the Senate to go along with his unprecedented maneuver to escalate the CIA's war. Here, anything could happen. So when the House and Senate defense appropriators met, Wilson adopted a simple strategy of building up chits. "I voted for everything anyone proposed, no matter what," he recounts. "I kissed every ass in the room." Wilson voted for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons, systems that more often than not were to be built in districts where the men he sat with came from. He waited until his friend Senator Ted Stevens asked if there was anything else to be considered from the House side. "Yes," Wilson said, rising to his feet. "I'd appreciate $40 million for the Afghan freedom fighters, with $17 million of that specifically earmarked for getting them a better anti-aircraft gun than they presently have." He used a phrase that Doc Long had first coined and that would later become his trademark in such deliberations. "This is the only place in the world where the forces of freedom are actually fighting and killing Russians." The House appropriators, of course, stood as one with Wilson. To his surprise, no one on the Senate side objected. "I looked around the table and was flabbergasted. No one blinked. No one said no." Wilson says that moment was a revelation. It was as if he had pushed on a door and discovered there was no lock and no one to complain if he charged in.